Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. During the first half of the 20th century, the US introduced state laws that imposed restrictions on many women's work outside the home. In some states, female employees had restricted hours and special treatment and were barred from many physical occupations. Well, these laws seem bizarre in 2025, so why were they introduced? And why were they eventually repealed? In the first of three episodes to celebrate International Women's Day, I spoke to Anne Hanusch of the University of Mannheim about what motivated the political movements to keep women out of the workplace and what eventually brought them back in. Anne, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim.
Now, this paper was a lot of fun to read, partly because of how extraordinary some of these laws to protect women were. Can you give me examples of some of these labour laws that specifically targeted women?
Sure. So these laws included things like restrictions on the hours women could work, so maximum hour laws. Mm-hmm. There were seating laws basically requiring employers to have a seat if they hire a woman, but not for men.
So women had to be able to sit down.
Exactly.
Wow.
Other laws included weight loss, so women could only lift up to 20 pounds at work, even though at home they would lift children that are heavier than that.
A lot of women listening to this are saying, this is our lives, lifting weights that were heavier than that. Now, this is in the US. Which US states introduced these rather extraordinary laws and when?
These laws were actually quite widespread. So okay. We saw them popping up across all US states at various times. They started as early as the 1850s. So Wisconsin, for example, around that time, introduced the maximum hour law. And from then, they were just spreading throughout the entire country.
And what arguments were made in favor of these laws? What was the public justification for them?
So the term protective labor laws gives you a little bit of a hint. The reason for these laws was to protect women from being exploited on the job. So women needed special protection against working long hours or working for extremely low wages.
But social workers know well that they can dissuade only a few from the idea of becoming big city business girls. They know that $20 a week and her own latchkey is the dream of every mining town Cinderella. A dream no warning can kill.
And how long did these laws last? When was this legislation replaced?
They lasted for quite a while, up until the mid-1960s.
Wow, as late as that.
As late as that. And in 1964, the Civil Rights Act, actually Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, prohibited discrimination based on gender. And that's when a series of Supreme Court cases came into effect that essentially ended the era of state protective legislation.
Now, there has been some research into this before, across the social sciences. What are the conventional explanations for why these laws were introduced?
One of them I've already given you.
Yes.
It is to protect women's health, especially, but also the health of children. You know, women being at work would leave children alone at home. So There was definitely a concern. But there was also a concern about the competition that women may pose for men.
Right.
As they started entering the labor market and went into the same jobs that especially unskilled men were doing.
In the United States today, the world of business is no longer a man's world. In New York City alone, 1 million women march to work each morning.
If you accept these explanations, what then becomes the explanation for why this changes?
So the explanation of why this changes is that women just started entering the labor market at very high rates, especially in the 60s and 70s. We saw that married women started working a lot. And at that point, these restrictions were actually limiting the employment opportunities of women and also the earning opportunities of households that included women that were working in the market.
So now you've gone a step further and you've created an economic model that tries to explain why these laws were introduced and why they were replaced as well. What causes you to doubt the completeness of the existing explanations?
The goal of these economic models is to organize our thoughts or to streamline our thinking. And the goal of our economic model is to assess whether we can identify one mechanism that can both explain the introduction and the abolition of these labor laws, and also match the timing. So during the periods that we actually observed these laws in the United States.
I see. And what goes into your model? What are the important elements of it?
In this model, we have to think of two main elements. The first elements are households. What types of households do we want to include? We decided that we want to distinguish between married and single households. If households include men, we want to think of skilled and unskilled men.
Right.
Because they work in different jobs. And when we think of women, we want to distinguish them by their what we call home productivity. So if women have a high home productivity, they prefer to stay at home rather than working in the market. The reason we include this is just to match a large fraction of households at the turn of the 20th century where women were staying at home and men were working in the market.
And what do we mean by home productivity? What is that productivity?
It basically means that women were not unproductive, but they were working at home, cooking, cleaning, engaging in what economists call home production. So creating something valuable for the household that the household enjoys, but it doesn't include working in the market.
I see. And that a home production was quite hard physical labor at that time.
For sure, yes. We thought about households, but we also have to think about the production side of the economy. And here we think of two sectors. One is agriculture. So here we're thinking about family farms, where men and women work alongside and their tasks or the work they do is complementary in producing the agricultural good. The modern sector, where we more think of working in a factory, here unskilled men and women are actually competing for the same jobs. Or put differently, an unskilled male worker could be replaced by a woman, and that creates competition between men and women in the model.
Also, you have the introduction and the replacement of these laws has to be part of this. Who gets to decide where laws are brought in and when they're repealed?
We stick to what we saw in history, meaning especially that prior to 1920, women did not have the right to vote in the United States.
So before 1920, men are deciding.
Exactly. It's only men who can vote on the introduction of these laws. After 1920, like we've seen in the United States history, both men and women can actually vote.
So from these laws, who's gaining economically and who loses?
It turns out from all these different household types that we consider, there's actually only two household types that economically gain from these restrictions.
Ah.
These types are unskilled single men, because
right.
Remember, they compete with women, and unskilled married men who married to a wife that is not working. For both household types, wages are reduced as more and more women enter the labor market. And that's why they economically gain from restricting female employment. All other household types are against these types of labor restrictions for women.
And in this story, why eventually are these laws repealed and replaced?
Female labor force participation is key. We do see that female labor force participation increased tremendously, especially in the 1960s and 70s, meaning that there is a larger share of households that suffers from restricting female employment or that no longer gain from restricting female employment.
And so does the data we see, the empirical data we see from the United States, does that fit this model pretty well?
Yeah. So that's, I think, one of the most beautiful parts of the paper. The model predicts that labor laws are introduced around 1920, which is in the data we actually see between 1910 and 1920, most of the protective labor legislation in the United States was introduced. Regarding the abolition, the model predicts that laws would be abolished in 1960. And as I told you, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 closely matches that timeline. So we have a very simple model with one key mechanism that closely aligns both the introduction and the abolition of these labor laws in the model and in the data.
as you say, your model has it's a really simple, it's a very elegant explanation for it. It's a very economic explanation for it. Does it rule out those more sociological explanations that we get, like education, political action, and awareness of rights as drivers of these changes?
You know, I would say the following regarding increasing female education. I would say that that is probably a catalyst for the kind of mechanism that we have modeled here, mm-hmm. in a sense that as females increase their education, they would potentially earn higher wages in the market. So these labor restrictions are even more costly for them. But our model predicts that all women, as they enter the labor market, actually lose from these protective labor laws. Regarding political action and awareness, I would say that those are probably outcomes of women entering the labor market and running against these types of restrictions, right? As more and more women realize that their employment opportunities are limited by law, they have the incentive to organize, become politically active, and actually push back.
So you're seeing this as the outcome of an economic process, which then helps to drive the change.
That's definitely possible.
This is a sort of structural transformation model. As the structure of the economy changes, therefore it helps to change the rights of women in the workplace. There are other economies that are still going through their structural transformations. We would expect, therefore, to see similar restrictions on women's work in those economies. Do we see that?
We don't see the exact type of restrictions or exact type of labor laws today that we observed at the beginning of the 20th century in the US. Mm-hmm. However, I will say that in high-income countries or countries that are further along the structural transformation path, we do see more labor laws that ensure equality in the workplace, that give women the same access to jobs as men, that have provisions against employment discrimination by gender, or that protect women from sexual harassment in the workplace.
Okay, other question. Then going back to the 1850s, what about other places in the world that were at a similar state of economic development to the US? Did they have similar laws?
That's a great question. In fact, they did. Especially in Europe, we've seen similar types of protective legislation. For example, in England in 1848, the first maximum hour law for women was introduced. And we've seen similar things in France and in Germany as well.
Does this also mean that education and advocacy programs, which are often cited as a way to change norms around women's participation in the labor force, which, as we know, is still much lower in low-income countries than it is in the US or in Europe, those routes to ensure more participation, might they not work?
I would say quite the opposite. According to our research, fostering or increasing female labor force participation actually fosters political change. In a sense that more and more families and households in the economy are negatively impacted by restricting female employment and are actually gaining from equality in the labor market.
That's a wonderful piece of history with so much relevance to today. Thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper is called Political Economy of Laws to Protect Women, and the authors are Matthias Dubke, Hanno Förster, Anne Hanusch, and Michelle Turtild.
Next time on Box Talks Economics, how can we reduce the stigma of menstruation for schoolgirls?